Welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here, as we're here every day, Monday through Friday, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And we're doing a little change-up today. Normally, Friday is Steve Gardonis's day, but Steve Gardonis hit Tom McDonald over the head with a rock and tied him up in a sack and did the show on Tuesday. And Tom was finally able to wriggle free from the sack, and so is here for the Friday show instead.
And hi, as my punishment to Steven, he shall have to be bound in a chair watching an endless loop of Zack Snyder superhero movies from now until the end of time.
You're a fiend.
I am a fiend.
Not that.
No.
Yeah. So anyway, we're here today with Tom. Tom is a blogger at the National Catholic Register. For a long time, maintained the blog God and the Machine, which you can still find out there on the web now, right? God
Some of it. I mean, I don't tell anybody, but I deleted my archives. You can me at thomaslmcdonald.com.
Okay.
I shoved some of them there, but I took them off of Patheos because really, to heck with those guys. Sure. But you're back in Patheos, I understand.
I'm back at Patheos.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I quit my blog at Patheos at the end of the year because it looked like I was going to have like buku amounts of work. And so I thought something's got to give, in the words of Ella Fitzgerald. And so I stopped the blog, but being an extrovert trapped in an introvert's job, as I am, that's what being a writer is sitting in a room by yourself typing things and hoping that someone reads them. And mostly, you know, you hear back from people who say, you suck, and I hated what you wrote. And it's like, thank you, you know. Well, I mean, when was the last time you wrote a letter to the editor saying, I agree with everything you said? Thank you. Nobody does that. So writing the feedback loop tends to be a negative feedback loop.
Yes, it does.
It tends to be people writing you because they hate you and the horse you rode in on.
Right.
And that thing you wrote was terrible and you're a bad person. And so that's what you hear. So that's kind of a negative feedback loop. So I thought I have a natural attraction to social media because
like to make I'm an extrovert. Angry?
Well, but partly because I'm an extrovert, and I do, you know, there are bonds of friendship that I maintain through social, such as with you, for example.
Yes, and I actually pulled the plug on my social for all of May, so I'm not there.
So, but it's probably not because of me. At least I hope, and I'm going to continue to tell myself that.
You know, mostly was because no, I don't know. Okay.
So I thought I started to look at how I've been spending my time over the last few months, and it turned out that so far, at least, I don't have the bodacious workload that I thought I was going to have. And so I've been on social media, kind of maintaining those social ties with people and trying in the effort to not go crazy here in my little room by myself. And I finally thought, well, I'm doing all this stuff on social media anyway, and why not get paid for that instead of not getting paid for that?
Being
and that
paid
seemed
good
to me. Yes. And plus, there have been certain things that I've written where I've thought, you know, I'd like more people to have read that. And so the nice thing about writing for Patheos is you can set up a deliberate account, which will send what I write. You know, that will be, it'll be seen because it's on Patheos, but it'll also go to Facebook. It'll also go to Twitter. And so it expands the audience. And so all of those things seemed like, well, if I'm going to be doing this stuff anyway, I might as well get some money for it.
Money's good.
Money's good. It's
it's all about the Benjamins. It's all That's about it. The Tubmans.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's why I'm back on Patheos. And so I'll be doing that. I'm going to be doing it on a more catch-as-catch-can basis because I do have other things that I'm trying to get done. I got an essay that I got to get cracking on this week. And, you know, other projects and book projects and so forth. But yeah, so I'm back on Patheos. And you know, once again, I mean, now, as is my custom, you know, I've been accepted back into the higher circles of national media. We'll be having Kim and Kanye over later today from Mimosa's poolside, and
cool.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So that's just how I roll, and that's why I got into Catholic writing, is because of the wealth and power and popularity, and
that's all right. That
rubbing elbows with the beautiful people.
You're in that sweet spot where those three things overlap, and you're just like in the zone now of wealth, power, and popularity of Catholic.
What it's about? It's what it's about, man.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, you're just hanging out with Kim and Kanye, and Bishop Barron and Brandon Vaught. And
that's what it's like. You know, it's funny. I used to get like emails from people. Years ago, I would get these emails from people. So like Amy Wellborn, woman that I know, accomplished writer, Catholic writer. She was living at the time in Indiana. And I would get these emails from people asking me, you know, do you know where Amy is today? And I'm like, she lives in Indiana. It wasn't my turn to watch her, you know?
We work at a big desk all together.
But it was like that. I would get these emails that you sort of got the sense that somebody thought that, you know, Jimmy Akin and Scott Hahn and I were like every Friday night we get together and like knock back some brewskis and, you know, compare notes and talk about what we were going to be doing next week. It's like, I never see these people, you know. They have their own lives. I live in Seattle. It's the upper left-hand corner of the map. I don't see or know anybody. I'm out here in the far west, you know. So that was a strange thing. But what have you been up to?
I've been sick. I had a cold that lasted a week, and then because I'm on immunosuppressants, which if you have an option between life with immunosuppressants and life without, pick the life without, because that means it always settles in the bronchitis. So So I've always got like a month of feeling crummy after I get a simple common cold. So I've been mostly doing that. I haven't been writing much. I just wrote a piece for Elizabeth Scalia on the return of Latin. Believe it or not, if I had asked you where Latin fit in the hierarchy of top 10 languages being studied in America today, what where might you put that?
10.
Third.
Really?
Yeah, after Spanish and French. Sure. My daughter, bragging time, just took a gold medal in the National Latin Exam, really? Which means I think she only got one wrong out of 40. And the National Latin Exam first... I think was 1978, had 7,000 people sat for it. This year it was, I think, 165,000. And they give out, you know, awards and grants and stuff. So Latin is actually kind of, making a bit of a comeback in schools.
Sonia, Henny's tutu. I did not know that.
Yeah, it is. So, my daughter's a Latin scholar. So
that is fantastic. Well done.
Yeah, so you can look at Alatea on Wednesday. There's a story there. I quote one of my daughter's friends and her teacher, and it all came about because of Thomas More College. They were putting out, you know, this bragging press release of all their students who took the National Latin Exam, and I'm like, my daughter took that. Cut it out.
You know, I've got a friend, David Kerp. He's teaches at Ohio University, a history professor, and they homeschool their kids, and Dave and his girls are wicked smart. Well, and so is his wife, wicked smart. And so anyway, they're talking the other day, he's telling his teenage daughter, you know, by the time Alexander the Great was your age, he was well on the way to conquering the known world. She didn't even pause. She looked at him and said, Alexander had Aristotle as his tutor. I only have you.
Wow. That's so an epic burn. That is both pride and shame, because yes, she knows it and she burned you on it.
She knows how to use that information well. Yeah, so that it's was...
some moment in parenthood where you don't know whether to be proud or appalled, so you go with both.
Yeah. So that was good. Oh, cool. Yeah. I will look forward to that article. Yeah.
And other than that, I've been reading, believe it or not, I'm reading 1,200 pages. It's in two volumes of commentary on One Enoch, and I've read almost 200 pages so far, and I got to the end of chapter one
of Enoch. Holy moly.
Now, for those who don't know, One Enoch is, you know, a non-canonical, very strange book with a very interesting history, but it's the longest book in the Bible is Jeremiah, is about 30 some odd thousand words. I'm pretty sure One Enoch is longer than that. It's like 103 or 108 chapters long. The book of Enoch, One Enoch, wow, is incredibly long and incredibly dense and complicated. So it took 200 pages for this author just to clear his throat and get to the end of John on the commentary. And it wasn't wasted space because it's so bafflingly complex that you actually have to kind of really dig into it before you're even ready to like read the text. There we go.
Well, we'll talk about it when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back with Tom McDonald right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Tom McDonald, knower of all arcana, all Catholic arcana, and we're talking about one of the, you know, I mentioned this, I did a little write-up on the show for my Facebook page, just so people could know we're on the air today, and one of the things I said was that when you've got a tradition that's 2,000 years old, and spans every continent and every culture, you're going to wind up with just a lot of bric-a-brac in the attic.
Oh, yeah.
Just interesting, weird stuff. One of those pieces of bric-a-brac is One Enoch, which is actually, I mean, it's older than the church, because you said it was worked on for about three centuries. By
all right, here's authors. The scoop with One Enoch. Let's just put it in some quick context here. Okay. The latest book of the Bible proper is Daniel, which is probably 3rd to 2nd century BC. Okay. Folded after that are what the Catholics call the Deuterocanonicals, which we do consider canonical and the Protestants don't. But mm-hmm. They're kind of canonical, but slightly down a notch. We realize that because they were left out of the Hebrew Bible, but they were put into the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, we consider them canonical, but kind of in a different space. What that means, canonical means, is it can be used to inform theology and it can be used for worship. But for those who are not familiar with the books the Protestants don't have, it's 1 and 2 Maccabees, Tobit, Judith, Wisdom, Sirach, Baruch, and some very interesting additions to Daniel, which, as I just said, was the latest book. So that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. The latest book of the Catholic Bible was probably around 150 BC. So we're closing into the life of Jesus already. So we're already
talking about the Old Testament
here. The Old Testament. We're already moving into the realm of Proto-Christianity is not the word, but very late Second Temple Judaism that lays the groundwork for what will emerge in Christianity. And Jesus will actually comment on some of these things in different ways. And the New Testament will kind of pull in arguments from this period of Jewish history about the judgment and the resurrection and things right. like this. So you find this really interesting theological cultural stew that goes from, let's say, the 3rd century BC to the 1st century AD. Now, Jews didn't stop writing books just like we didn't, just because Jesus came along. There are many, many apocryphal books that post-date Christianity.
Right.
They don't figure into the Hebrew Bible. They're not, but, you know, they're a work of the rabbinical schools, the Talmudic schools, of different strains of Judaism. And mixing in all there is the Dead Sea Scrolls, which adds another window of another culture that was not Christian. You know, there's a lot of theories that the Dead Sea Scrolls had something direct to say about Christianity. But what we learn from the Dead Sea Scrolls is, again, what this ferment of debate was that was going on at the time.
And the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Qumran sect that puts together the Dead Sea Scrolls, they're Jews, but they're not Jews who like the temple elite very much.
No, it's an it's really fascinating when you dig into this. See, when you dig into Christian history, most people, you know, I did, and everybody will, go into the early days of the church history and find those documents left out of the Bible, but that could have made the cut. One Clement, the Didache, the Shepherd of Hermas, the Epistle of Barnabas.
Make the cut in some places. So what they you've do. Got... Yeah, and so you have some dioceses, for example, just so people have a handle on Catholic thinking about Scripture, especially in the early church. It's not, well, we've got this book now, so let's build a church on top of it.
Right.
What you've got is a church which has a liturgy. That's the big thing that the church is centered around. So the new covenant, if you asked, an early, you know, early first century Christian, what the New Testament is, and you asked them in Greek, they would point you to the Eucharist. That's the New Testament. This is the cup of the cup of the covenant, in my blood, the new and everlasting covenant in my blood. And that's what a testament is. It's the same word as covenant. And so it's only when the church is like starting to think about what do we read while we're celebrating this Eucharist? What are the holy writings that we read? Well, that's the New Testament got to be called the New Testament because this is the stuff that we read in close liturgical proximity to the Eucharist. That's how the New Testament came about. And so different churches had slightly different collections of books that they would read.
And some of the stuff that was read, one Clement would have been read. This is the first letter of Clement to the Corinthians, if I'm remembering.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And very similar to the Pauline corpus, but actually written by Clement, the third pope.
Right.
And the reason it was not included in the New Testament was because, and this actually, we attest, we talk about, you know, legitimacy and history and witness and everything on this show a lot. There's a good example for you, because these documents were liturgical, but when they were canon making the actual list of the books in the Bible, and we have the Moratorian canon. I mean, I could, you know, I don't want to prattle on about canon making, it's tedious, but they said, we're going to make a cutoff here, and the cutoff's going to be first generation eyewitnesses. You know, it's going to be people who actually, you know, walked and talked with Jesus, or were the first generation of apostles like Paul, or, you know, their co-workers. So that Clement was a little too removed from the actions of the New Testament. So Clement didn't make the cut, but remained very important, and you really couldn't do better than going to read the first letter of Clement, or the Didache, which is kind of a catechetical kind of, how would you describe the Didache? It's basically instructing people in the faith. It's kind of like, here's what Christianity is kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So you see all these things, and then you get the wider, you widen the net, and then you get the heretics who start spinning new scriptures out of their imaginations and other parts of their body. So you get the Gnostics coming up with crazy stuff, and the Manichaeans, and you get these people just kind of inventing new stories and wrapping them in Christian clothing, and you're squinting at them and say, that's not for real. Yeah. Now, Enoch began to coalesce. Enoch is, like I said earlier, is huge. Enoch began to coalesce probably in the 3rd century, maybe the 4th, But roughly around the time of Daniel, and it's little discrete sections. You know, there's lots of pieces of Enoch that you can tell are apart. There's a book of parables. There's an astronomical book. There's dream visions. There's the book of the Watchers, which tells the story of the Watchers, the angels who were came down to instruct humans, mated with the, found the women very attractive, mated and formed the Nephilim. And 36 chapters of the Book of Enoch kind of explores this area of primeval history and the Watchers. And then a letter, allegedly, from Enoch. And all this stuff was plugged in separately. This is all probably written by different hands, but towards an end. And what that end is apocalyptic. Now, we don't quite know, have a good grasp, I don't think, a lot of people, on what apocalyptic is. It is not end of the world. That does not define an apocalypse. Mm-hmm. There's only one apocalypse in the New Testament, and that is the book of Revelation. And really, there's only one apocalypse in the Old Testament, and that's Daniel. And there's pieces of apocalypse scattered about, Ezekiel, elsewhere. And Jesus has pieces of apocalypse as a genre that he talks, the sheep and the goats, Matthew 24. You know, there's little apocalyptic hints here and there. But what apocalypse is, technically, in Bible, you know, academic terms, is a literature of revelation that kind of has a narrative framework of a witness who has had a truth that's been given to him by an otherworldly being to disclose a reality that's unseen, and that points usually to the, not only to a supernatural world. It's both spatial and temporal, but to a time, so that it almost always, and people will debate this with me, and they're welcome to, it almost always has to do with judgment, mm-hmm. with the good and the bad being judged. So here, you know, so when Jesus talks about the sheep and the goats, he's engaging in a kind of Jewish apocalyptic that they would have known right away.
Right.
That they'd been working this genre for about 300 years. And one of the things that was, you know, probably one of the best sellers, there's a lot of pieces of it at Qumran with the Dead Sea Scrolls, was this one Enoch, which kind of is allegedly by Enoch, who walked with God and was no more, Genesis tells us. It is believed that Enoch was assumed into heaven like Mary. It is believed that Enoch was taken up bodily in lore.
Right.
Now, Enoch was the father of Methuselah and the great-grandfather of Noah, and I think the seventh son, if I'm recalling, of Seth, so the seventh descendant from Seth, who was the third son of Adam and Eve. Uh-huh. So Enoch had this body of literature that developed, and it became very visionary and very, very strange. And it sought, what you see is a real eschatological concern, which means end times, of people who are going to be judged, of these battles between good and evil, like the sheep and the goats. And you see this in the Dead Sea Scrolls too, the sons of light and sons of darkness. You know, you see this coming through a bit in Jesus's teachings. So what you get with Enoch is a real weird grab bag of these visions and beliefs.
Okay. Well, we'll see this after the break. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we'll be back right after this.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here with Tom McDonald, and we are available for a good talking to. If you want to join us, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can also text us at that number. You can tweet us at Breadbox Media. I always throw the phone number out there in the quixotic hope
It's like a somebody message. Will call one.
It's
day.
Like a message in a bottle, you know. You just and we have gotten calls. I mean, you know, now and then.
Never on my show.
Well, you know, call and make him feel loved. 1-573-4-BREAD-4 There you go.
Before we go too much further, and since we're at the bottom of the hour, as they say on radio, I should put out the big red warning about One Enoch, is it is a heretical book. It is non-canonical, and if you're not well-grounded in scripture and Bible study and Second Temple Judaism and apocryphal literature and pseudo-epigrapha, you might not want to dabble in it too much, because it's not non-canonical just because it happened to be written at a strange time and in strange conditions. It's non-canonical because it's not true.
Right.
Well, you know, it's not written by Enoch, and it's heretical.
Oddly enough, in a Protestantized culture, one of the things that, for all the vociferousness and division that happens in Protestantism, one of the things that's kind of endemic to American culture, which is a Protestant culture, is this notion that the Bible is a book set apart, which, of course, I mean, that's a Catholic idea, too. We set it apart because we're going to use it in our liturgies. That's where the Bible came from. But it's easy to forget that when the Bible hits other cultures that have, like, no rootedness at all in the Judeo-Christian tradition, and very often, of course, it can happen even within our culture. Witness the Book of Mormon. You can have people who will look at it and say, this is a terrific basis for a whole lot of fan fiction.
Yeah. That's what it is. It's fan fiction. It really is.
And yeah, well, I think that's the best definition I've ever heard of the Book of Mormon, is it's King James Version fan fiction. And I think that's exactly what it is. But the thing is, you know, we've seen it hit other cultures. And a lot of times it's people in the West are completely unaware of this. So, for example, in China, in the mid-19th century, there was something called the Taiping Rebellion, where this guy who had just, some Chinese guy with, like, absolutely no other background of contact with Christianity got a hold of a King James Bible and just went bonkers with it and decided that he was God's other son. And not only convince himself of this, but also convince millions of Chinese that, you know, he was going to lead them to, and it was just this absolutely bonkers, crazy religious movement, which wound up resulting in a rebellion that killed millions of Chinese. This is all going on during our Civil War and in the 1850s. And people in the West are, like, oblivious. They know nothing about the Taiping Rebellion. But the thing is, for some reason, after that, China was, like, reluctant to welcome Christian missionaries. Because the last time we let you guys in, it resulted in this bizarre explosion of religious fervor from this nut and millions of his followers. One of the miracles that we're seeing right now, frankly, is that after that kind of background, and then after the reaction to it, which in part is what drove Chinese communist hostility. I mean, communists are hostile to the church anyway, but Chinese communists could kind of point to their history and say, you know, this is bad, right? We don't want this influencing Chinese society, because millions of people could get killed, and we want to kill those millions of people. We don't want, you know, crazy heretics to do it.
Right.
It's a miracle now that we're living in a time where by the year 2035, China is going to be the most Christian nation on earth. And so an outworking of grace, to be sure. But you know, this is, of course, why the church says, when you encounter this literature, do avail yourself of the helps provided by the tradition that gave you the literature, and don't just flake out because among other things, you will get, as you mentioned, you know, Jews didn't just stop writing books,
right,
with the coming of Christ. And so you get, you know, these loopy things like One Enoch. And but anyway, but fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it shows us that the apocalyptic form was very much in the water of Second Temple of late Judaism, and well into, you know, into their early rabbinical period. You know, most of the apocalypse is actually apocalypi were produced after Christ. You know, the apocalypse of Moses, the apocalypse of Abraham, a lot of these things are first and second century. So that tells us something, because as Christianity emerges out of Judaism, what Judaism was matters. You know, right. we go over, so Sadducees, Pharisees, you know, we kind of have this vague idea of conflict, you know, but what was it meaning? And what the apocalypse was saying was a kind of a call to righteousness in time for being judged, you know, and this vision was part of that. I'll give you two words. I can flash my rhetorical knowledge. There are two words that kind of are semi-relevant to understanding apocalypse, and it's protrepsis and paranesis. And those are two kinds of what we call hortatory, which is exhortation. And protrepsis is basically urging you to keep on being, is urging you to a new kind of life, while paranesis is urging you to kind of keep being good. You know, yeah. So there, one is telling you to keep it up. You're doing great. And the other is, no, you're actually terrible. Let's try something new. And you find both of these coming out in this apocalypse as they're being urged to an end time and to our judgment. And really, I said it earlier, but it is true. The book of Revelation is an apocalypse par excellence. It has everything. It has wild visions, but it also has a sense of judgment and a call to righteousness and a call to a better life. It's not there just to scare you. Yeah. It's layers and layers of symbolism that can be very dense and hard to penetrate, but they all tend towards an end, and they all wrapped in a narrative.
And that's one of the interesting things to note about it. When you look at, I'd be interested to see this about Jewish apocalyptic with Christian apocalyptic, meaning the Book of Revelation.
Sure.
And also, if you want, there are many apocalypses in the three synoptic gospels. They all have Jesus talking about the end times at one point. And what's interesting about Jesus' apocalyptic is that it's all temple centered. He talks about the destruction of the temple, and when you read it, it sounds like sometimes he's talking about the end of the world, and sometimes he's talking about the destruction of the temple. And so the temptation is to ask, well, which is it? And I think that Scott Hahn has very persuasively argued that the answer is yes.
Yes, it is. That was what I was about to jump in.
Yeah.
It's polyvalent. So,
right. And so the judgment that's going to fall on the temple in 70 AD is an image of the coming judgment. In the book of Revelation, what you see is a book that is deeply rooted with and symbiotic with, and I think this is why the church could never really get rid of it, although there are voices in the early church that, very much like Martin Luther would say later on, are saying, a revelation ought to reveal something. You know? But what you find when you look closely at the book of Revelation is it's a book that is structured like and modeled on the liturgy. So it begins with, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. In other words, I was at Mass. It was Sunday. And it then moves on to seven letters to seven churches saying in one way or another, repent, shape up. In other words, a penitential rite. And then it moves from there into the early chapters of Revelation to the opening of scrolls. And so you have these scrolls that no one can open except for a lamb who looks as if he'd been slain, who's also described as the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. He's the only one that can open the scrolls. And so what you're getting there is the Catholic theology of the Liturgy of the Word, that you have the Old Testament readings, which are, as Paul calls them, veiled until the coming of the gospel, until the Lamb takes the seal off and tells you what the meaning of the Old Testament writings were. And that's what Jesus does on the Emmaus Road. So he tells, you know, he talks about the law and the prophets, and the guys on the Emmaus Road are like, I don't get it. he's manifested to them how? Well, on the Emmaus Road, he's manifested to them in the breaking of the bread. That's when the eyes are open and they figure out, oh, this is actually Jesus. And then they realize that, as he told them, everything that was written in the law and the prophets is really about him. We will continue after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we'll be back with Tom McDonald and apocalyptic literature right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Sorry.
Doing a Julia Child for no apparent reason.
That's the voice of the, Groucho Marx dowager. Kind of voice. You know, that's the way.
Margaret Dumont, right?
Yeah, Marx Brothers characters. Yeah. The stuffy woman would always say that. Things like talking that voice. If you ever... get a chance to see the Hudsucker Proxy. There's also a
I haven't seen that, but it showed up on streaming, so I might watch it.
Oh, just watch it. It's a hoot. I love it.
Maybe I'll do that tonight.
It will crack you up. But
we were on Apocalypse and Apocrypha. One interesting thing about and this is something else that I had bounced off. See, this stuff's all rattling around in my head because I'm reading it now and I'm forgetting. You know, some of the stuff that's to come. Two phrases that appear a lot in Enoch are Son of Man and Ancient of Days. We'd seen, obviously, Son of Man is not unique to Enoch. It's in Ezekiel.
It's in Daniel, too.
It's in Daniel, which is, you know, almost the more interesting thing. And Daniel also has Ancient of Days, you know. So, yeah. You know, these things matter. How they kind of come together and what people were thinking. Now, if you actually were to go ahead and read Enoch, you would see that it's pretty, pretty wild. I mean, one of the things I remember that's unintentionally funny is that there's these angels that sprout wings and fly around with a cord to measure righteous people, with like a rope that they measure righteous people. And I'm not even sure what that was, if they're measuring how tall they are or how many they are or what's the cord. But one of the common things you see, you know, one of the things is these wild visions of like a crystal palaces surrounded by flaming walls and, you know, giant portals and gates and angel, and there's lots of angelology, you know, lots of stuff about the angels. But here's where Enoch came upon trouble. Now, Enoch was used by Tertullian and other church fathers. Origen used it, but was suspicious of it. Other church fathers cited it. It's actually quoted directly in the letter of Jude. There's two lines in the Epistle of Jude that are directly from Enoch. But it ran up against the shoals of St. Augustine and never recovered because Enoch has an interesting idea about the origin of sin in us and evil. Well, obviously, Augustine, in the theory of original sin, which we don't need to, you know, rehash here, mm-hmm. Enoch offers an entirely different model. And sin entered the world when the Watchers, these angels, were sent down to kind of help humans. And there's this whole pattern of what they do. Like, some gave us metal, some taught us cosmetics and things like that. I'm serious. I don't remember if that's in Enoch now, but they're all kind of assigned different kind of material actions and different things. So, and they kind of found these earth ladies really attractive, so they mated with them. And Genesis tells us this, and created the Nephilim, which are these race of horrible giants. Now, in Enochian belief, that's these demons were unleashed on the world, and that's the source of evil, not the original.
Oh, really? Sin. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, and again, that's debatable, because, you know, you can read Enoch a lot of ways. And
right,
the problem with us now dealing with Enoch at all, and with Christians recovering some interest in the history of it, is that it was seized in the 17th century by occultists, especially John Dee, believed he was given the Magus John Dee, a magician who was very famous in the Renaissance, believed he was given an Enochian language through scrying, through these occult practices that, okay, that created an entire Enochian ritual system. So Christians weren't going to touch this stuff for a couple hundred years because of the, right, associations. But now, you know, we're kind of getting past that and realizing that this tells us, like Qumran, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, like the Deuterocanonicals, like the Pseudo-Epigrapha, this tells us something. You know, and it tells us something interesting about what, yeah, Jews were thinking in certain schools.
It's interesting. Well, one of the things that I learned from Scott Hahn, speaking of this, a complaint that you get sometimes is that we shouldn't read anything written after the time of the New Testament because you know, the church went off the rails and it all started getting, you know, full of legends and so forth. And one of the exhibit A in this claim is that First Clement mentions the legend of the phoenix.
Oh, yes.
You know, the bird that is consumed by fire and then arises from its own ashes and so on and so, right, forth. But what's interesting is when you read First Clement, what's very plain is that Clement is not interested in founding some sort of Catholic doctrine of the phoenix. This is a sermon illustration, right? It would be just like if your priest stands up in front of you and says, you know, I saw this thing on, you know, Agent Carter, or I was watching Marvel, you know, Civil War movie, and it made me think of this thing, this idea, and then goes on to illustrate whatever. That's what Clement's doing. Clement is not interested in whether or not even the phoenix exists. He just kind of takes the image as a matter of course. But he doesn't make any statement on how, you know, Catholics must believe and profess in the existence of the phoenix. That's not his point.
Well, I mean, if you look at City of God, St. Augustine, it's the first 300 pages, 400 pages. It's talking about the gods. It's talking about, you know, when, right, he says we're not trying to defend Christianity against accusations that they caused the fall of Rome. He goes into immense, it's a huge historical grand survey of Roman history and mythology and theology and all this. It's like saying he was saying, well, this is all true. That's not it. It's just an illustration. I mean, the Romans would have inherited the phoenix from Herodotus, you know, from a lot of ancient sources.
Yeah, and in part, of course, you know, what strikes me, and Augustine is one of the people that is doing this, Augustine is circumspect about natural sciences. He knows his limits.
Mm, yes.
And he knows that he doesn't know things, and he knows that even the sciences don't know a lot of things, but at the same time, he recognizes that when the sciences really have evidence for their position, the smart money is listen to them because they know what they're talking about. They've done the research, and so he'll in his comments on Genesis, he'll say, you know, don't say dumb things about the spices when you don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
And, but, you know, one, he will run into questions like, you know, we've heard travelers' tales that there are dog-headed men on the other side of the world. What do we do if there are dog? He's not saying there are dog-headed men on the other side of the world. All he's saying is, could be true. We don't know. I've never been to the other side of the world. There's the world is a strange place. There are all kinds of weird things. If there are dog-headed men, what do we do about that? How do we incorporate that into our thinking?
Right.
He does. What he doesn't do is say the Bible doesn't mention dog-headed men, so they can't exist.
No, he wants to know if they can be baptized when he goes into that. He's like, do they have souls? You know, and he and being Augustine, he works this out meticulously. This was a mind like no other, you know. So when you fight, it's oddly, I hate to use the word, but it's oddly modern encountering Augustine because he's thinking a lot of the same stuff we are.
That's so true. Yeah. And he's got a lot of the problems that we have, you know. he's a guy in many ways, you know, he's a guy who has spent his life
we're in a collapsing society in the ruins of a collapsing nation, you know. I mean, we're right where Augustine was 1600 years later. We're right back at it.
So, you know, you've got a lot of saints, early saints who were celibate all their life. Augustine is a guy who's slept around a lot, and he knows he knows that this is not making him happy, you know. And at the same time, he's a guy who is saying things like, you know, oh Lord, make me chaste, but not yet. That's a very postmodern problem, you know. And so he's thinking, you know, he's somebody who is really open to the reality that the world is a really big and strange place, and be cautious about making hard and fast statements about universal truths when you don't really know that that's true.
It's even unusual. I've read a lot of fathers, and his mind is, it's not a knock on them, but something very, very appealing to us today in the 21st century about that, the way he approaches these questions.
Yeah. And so it creates, especially in the West, it creates a mind, a Western mind, that's really open to the reality that this world can be a strange place, and that it's fine to explore that, you know. And that will eventually lead, of course, is going to lead to the foundation of the sciences, which are a product of medieval Latin Europe. That's what other elements show up in other cultures, but nobody brings it together until medieval Latin Europe puts it all together, and we really get the birth of the sciences. Yep. Well, hey, Tom, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer was the famous Ethan Bolin. And I've been your host today, Mark Shea, and I will be back on Monday with Simca Fisher. Until then, bye-bye.
Good night.